You are listening to Sid Weighs In. We're a Tuck School business professor, associate dean for executive education, and an expert on strategy and leadership. Sidney Finkelstein shares his views on what leaders are doing, why they are doing it, and whether it makes sense for them and for you.
Hi, this is Sid Finkelstein from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. I'm a professor here and a columnist for the BBC, where I write a column called Sid Weighs In. And this is our podcast to talk about it and draw out some interesting lessons. And I'm delighted to welcome our guest host today. Deirdre, would you like to say a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Deirdre Garahan. I'm a second-year student at the Tuck School of Business here. I came from financial services, and I'll be going into consulting and after graduation in a few more months.
In a few more months. Where are you going to be? In somewhere in the U.S.?
I'll be in New York City working for Monitor Deloitte.
Yeah, that's great. So Deloitte bought Monitor a few years ago. Is that what happened?
Correct.
Yeah, and Monitor's the company out of HBS originally. Was that Michael Porter's company?
Yes, it definitely was. And so, yeah, it's a great group of people. It was fantastic kind of seeing the integration this summer, seeing kind of expertise on both sides. In particular, this summer I was on a project with an acquisition Monitor made of a group called Doblin, and they do innovation strategy consulting.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, that's going to fit our topic today quite well, I think.
Yes.
The title is The Secret of Thinking Small to Win Big. And what the column is about is, once again, simplicity, but in a little different way. Simplicity in addressing some really complicated or seemingly complicated strategic issues around M&A, around innovation, and around organizing. So maybe you'll read a bit of the column and we could chat about it and kind of draw out some lessons. And I'll be really interested to hear what your own experiences already have been about some of these topics.
Sounds great. So simplicity. It doesn't just make your everyday life better. There's an equal big payoff to companies that embrace the logic of simplicity, especially when undertaking what sounds like complex initiatives.
And what could be more complex than M&A, right?
Definitely.
it's the bane of many a company's existence because, the track record is really bad.
Yep.
Depending on which study you look at, one half to two thirds of all acquisitions actually destroy shareholder value for the acquiring company. It's really an incredible thing. But yet you keep seeing it at the level of literally trillions of dollars a year around the world. So there's something that's not quite working right. And I've thought for some time, well, of course, it's very complex. You can simplify this in a way that could really help. I think it's as I write in the column, it's powerful because it pushes you to focus on the most fundamental issues that determine success and failure, and not on the endless other distractions and issues that someone is always ready to bring up. And in M&A, it's a method I've been using now for some time in my own consulting with boards of directors. Really, M&A depends on three things, and I'd be curious to see what you think about this. Is it too simple? How does it relate to your own experience, working in recently and where you're about to go? So there's three things that you need, and I summarize it with the PSI framework. Is too strong a word because it's only three letters, but let's just say PSI. P is for price, the price you pay, and you got to make sure that's a reasonable, you don't overpay. S is the strategic logic of making the deal. So we're talking about the other S word, synergies and fit, and whether there's really value creation potential. And the I, of course, is the one that really gets messed up a lot, and that's integration. How do you integrate two different companies with two different cultures and make them work? So each one of these things are difficult. They're complex, but they are the three things. That's your agenda: price, strategic logic, and integration. What do you think?
I definitely think that is a strong framework to start with. I mean, when I even think of Monitor and Deloitte and seeing kind of the fantastic integration that's happened there, the emphasis that I've kind of heard on kind of those kind of three things, and especially that, that integration process at the end, looking at, in general, I think with consulting, you look at kind of frameworks and buckets of where you're going to put your attention. And I think those, looking at price, logic, integration, kind of cover the main aspects where I think a lot of companies will you know, bring in consultants and other people because they're so important to make sure you have that outside look.
Yeah, and boards of directors love this idea because mm-hmm. they don't have the luxury of having all the information. They got to rely on the CEO and the management team to explain what the deal is, why the deal is a good idea. And so these three questions is really all they care about. And they're not going to be able to, for better or for worse, get into the weeds in any one of them. Maybe for price, because that's one that's a bit easier
right.
in a way because of valuation models that exist. But it helps them kind of cut to the chase. And I think that's I think that adds a lot of value. And the thing that also makes the M&A track record so difficult, and you know, I write a little bit about this in the column, is that to win, you got to win on all three. That's really the tricky part. You know, if you think about that, price, strategic logic, integration. What if you won in two and you lost in the third? What would happen? I mean, you still have a failing, almost certainly have a failing acquisition, because you could pay a reasonable price. We can have potential from the strategic logic of the deal. But if you mess up integration, you're really not going to generate the value out of that deal. And a lot of companies, that's exactly what they've suffered from. But take any other combination as well. Even a, let's say, reasonable strategic fit, and you're integrating it pretty well, but the price you pay is such a gigantic premium, you'll never be able to catch up on that. So that's one of the reasons why I think M&A is such a difficult thing to get right. You got to win in all three. Two out of three is not good enough.
Do you think one of kind of the three is harder to obtain than the others,
yeah.
or kind of slips under the rug a little bit?
Well, I've seen problems with all three, but I think integration is probably the toughest.
Mm-hmm.
For one reason is I think it's underestimated how difficult it is. It's underestimated because you gather around working out the deal. You got the lawyers, you got your advisors, you got your Wall Street team, and they're analyzing the valuation model. It sounds very scientific.
Yeah.
It's not. If you've done that, valuation is very much of an art rather than a science.
Yes.
It's a magical how you can get the number to justify the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like, and there are numbers on it, so it sounds like that's the tough thing. And then the bankers go home, the lawyers go home, and then you got to figure out what to do. And what you have to do is a lot of nitty-gritty detailed work that we call integration. To me, integration is actually a massive organizational change process. And that's also a big job, but that's something we know something about at least. So I would put integration as probably the toughest one.
Yeah, that definitely seems to – a lot of our classes at Tuck now have been emphasizing more of the implementation aspect, kind of integration in general. And so I was curious because it seems
right.
that's kind of a trend that the cases that we're looking at are just getting brought up more and
yeah.
more.
Yeah, well, it also follows another kind of principle many people think, which is, you know, it's great to have a great idea, to have a great strategy,
mm-hmm.
but the winners are the ones that can execute on that. And you're better off having a reasonably good strategy that you execute at a world-class level than a genius strategy you can't execute on. I mean, it's a lot of startup failures, in fact, that have fallen to that trap, which kind of brings us to the second point.
Yeah, and I love this in the article that you point out that the same idea for simplicity and focus holds for innovation. And maybe it's one of the reasons that large companies struggle so much in adapting to change, while smaller companies seem so nimble. It's not necessary and can often be detrimental to lay out an innovative idea in excessive detail. You're almost always better off generating the good idea than testing and improving it without trying to perfect it. Striving for perfection is a sure way of derailing a potentially good innovative idea as anything you can imagine.
So what do you think about that?
Oh, I think this is powerful. It's something looking at innovation this summer that
mm-hmm.
You might have more of kind of a step-by-step process for, any kind of your normal core business. Mm-hmm. But looking at innovation, I definitely saw, I think, a disconnect of, understanding kind of more of an iterative process and kind of just improving bit by bit, and that's how you're dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're going to the consulting world. How do you get senior executives, how do you get a CEO to buy into that? When they want to have a model, they want to have a plan, and they want to go to war on that.
Yeah, I think you have to kind of lay out some of the financial benefits too of looking at innovative processes that work. And when you're looking at being able to improve things in iteration or kind of have, you know, fast failure with that and figure things out quickly, you can actually save a lot of money in the end.
Yeah, it sounds like a little bit of the lean startup mentality as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So that, you know, if you're able to, you know, test ideas and improve on them, you know, with kind of a smaller capital invested, then it, you know, it becomes a win-win that you can have innovative ideas, you're spending less money, and really carrying a business forward. I think when you put it down in a logical format of here are kind of the key levers for this business, here's what you can do with this model, it's pretty easy to follow.
Yeah. And in the column, I briefly mentioned Facebook, you know, the social media mm-hmm. giant. I wrote, didn't start with all the bells and whistles it has today. It almost certainly wasn't even imagined by CEO Mark Zuckerberg in the form it has today. The trick for the company and its managers will be to keep looking for opportunities to innovate in the fundamentally good idea and not get bogged down in a massive new model of what Facebook should be. I mean, the point really is what you said earlier, iteration. Iterating allows companies to adapt and adjust much more quickly and effectively than legislating or proclaiming even what the future will be. And it's a real trap, I think, when you try to do that. And I know where it comes from. It's not hard to see where it comes from because you got a lot of smart people that are used to figuring things out. And why can't they come up with a, quote, perfect solution? But mm-hmm. Perfection is a scary thing. I like striving to be the best at anything that you can do that you take on in your career and your life. Why not? But you can't let it bog you down. You can't let it slow you down. And you know, we got an entire Silicon Valley set of companies that keep iterating. We use the word pivot a lot.
Yes.
You know, keep adjusting. It's all about adaptability, flexibility, and gathering data and then adjusting to it. I guess that's kind of what you're going to be trying to teach or communicate to senior executives of bigger companies, where it might not be a comfortable thing to do.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think, can be counterintuitive, but you know, market conditions are changing, and getting, you know, growth and additional financial performance at the end of the day is going to be important. So I think there's a lot of lessons here we can learn from the innovation and some of these kind of smaller startups.
So let's go to the last part of the column. Ask you to do a quick read of maybe a couple of short paragraphs.
Sure. One final thought on simplicity, especially apropos to larger organizations. The bigger you get, the more important it is to organize your work across the various operations and activities of the firm. So how do you structure your large or rapidly growing enterprise? The good news is that there are four options that count for 99% of the possibilities. And if you know and think about these four, you can access which ones are right for you.
This is kind of cool, right? There's only four. Mm-hmm. And managing organizations or organization design, it's a complicated thing. So what are the four? So you could organize by your business by in terms of the product or service. So I use the example cloud services versus mobile, but it could be any product or service. Of course, you can do it by customer. Which industry do you focus on? And IBM famously did that when they made their major transformation back in the, I guess, the 90s under Lou Gerstner when they were really in trouble, and they completely restructured their organization to move from a functional focus to an organ to an industry focus or a customer focus. I mentioned function already. That's the third one, and then by region or country. So you could do it by product or service. You could do it by industry or type of customer. You could do it by function. You could do it by geographical region. That's it.
Yeah.
They're not easy, but at least you know these are the four to think about. And the additional problem that occurs for larger companies, there's an argument to be made that each of these four are good. They're all logical, but you can't choose all four. You know what most companies actually end up doing? Big companies end up doing? They'll choose two.
Matrix, yeah.
Bingo, matrix. And matrix, people hate that matrix structure because you're reporting straight up and you got other people with dotted line responsibilities. But the reason it happens is you got potentially four ways to organize your company. And more than one are really good. I mean, you want to connect to customers, of course. Mm-hmm. That's obvious. Yeah, there's a lot of advantage to being focused on specific products or services that you're creating from an innovation, product development, and even manufacturing point of view. And then there's huge differences in regions around the world. So you have country structures, and function is the fourth one, also could be relevant. So there's no way around the matrix. I guess we could be, we should be thankful that if there's logic for all four, we don't actually try to do all four.
Yes.
Because then, you know, then you really get into some some problems. So there you have it, Deidre. There are at least three areas where simplicity can help in how we think about these complex problems around M&A, around strategic innovation, and even around how we organize and structure our organizations. So there's hope for all of us. Thanks again, Deidre. That was a great discussion, and hopefully we got a lot of people thinking the right way about simplicity and complexity.
This has been Sid Wazin. If you would like to comment on this podcast, follow Professor Finkelstein on Twitter @SidFinkelstein, #SidWazin. Thank you for listening.